Hi, I'm Mike Nager, and you're listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hey there, welcome back for another edition of Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill podcast. Chefs on the Grill is a collaboration between Chicago Magazine and Hungry Magazine, and you can find all of our podcasts at www.chicagomag.com or www.hungrymag.com. This month I sit down with Natalie and Nick Zarzor from the Andersonville Sicilian-style pastry shop, Pasticceria Natalina. In a few short months, the Zarzor's attention to detail, such as importing sheep's milk ricotta, bitter almonds, and amarina cherries from Sicily, as well as their long hours in the kitchen dedicated to making handcrafted delicacies, has captured the palates of foodies and casual eaters alike. Enjoy the interview.
So I mentioned to you when I was driving by the other night, it was a Tuesday night,
uh-huh.
And you guys are closed on Tuesdays, and
yeah.
It was like 10:30 at night, and I saw the light on, I saw you guys working in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And in some ways it's a dedication of the craft that you guys have, and you know, the fact that this is probably a labor of love, but I guess I wondered, did you guys realize it was going to be so intensive and that you'd be, you know, here at 11 at night on your days off and working so hard?
I think we knew that it was going to be a lot of hard work, but many hours of work, hard work, is different than the expectation of all the emotional energy. The exhaustion of, you know, your mental state, and wouldn't you agree, just being so worried about everything all the time with the business, like you said, having a newborn baby and having a brand new business is a lot of the same trials.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah. So with the hard work and the long hours, we were prepared. But with all the emotional energy and the, I guess you could say, that feeling of being a new parent,
mm-hmm.
That's what we didn't expect.
You know, talking about craft, I mean, one of the things, you know, people made a lot about the fact that you guys fill the cannolis to order.
Yeah.
I've read that you import a lot of stuff, like mm-hmm. the sheep's milk ricotta and, you know, the cherries, the amarina cherries, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are kind of going to the end of the earth here for everything that you do.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, are there compromises, or where does compromise fit into the business? Does it? Are there things that you do that, you know, it just makes sense from a business standpoint, or is it all, you know, just always to the nth degree?
I would have to say that the only compromise that we would make is to not serve a product if it wasn't being received by our clientele. That doesn't mean that we would change the recipe or that we would stop using the ingredients that we believe in, because the imported ingredients give you the ethnic product as it should be. So you could make the product with domestic ingredients and get a different product than you intended. But where we don't do that is to say, okay, if you don't like this one type of cake, I won't make it. I'll give you something else to choose from. But that option that you'll get in place will still be just as authentic. It'll still include all the ingredients that we believe in and that we'll search for. We'll import it from overseas, but we won't water down the product.
And that
at
was
all.
The first. That was
that
first
was our first thing
when we even thought about the business. It's going to be imported because we are a boutique style. We are a pastry shop. We're not a bakery, and we want to keep it that way. I know sometimes you might have to change, as she's saying, only because change the recipe of. To a different quality recipe, like the cheesecake, for example. If they don't like chocolate chip, I'll make it without chocolate chip. But that sheep milk ricotta, a lot of people are dying over it. A lot of people don't like it. It's just a matter of preference. But
yeah.
What we believe in is what we're sticking with.
And no matter what type of cheesecake it is, you're never going to find a $2 slice of cheesecake. And it's not because we don't want to be more affordable. It's because things are priced at what the product is worth, both based on our labor and based on the cost of the ingredients. And we hope that people will understand. And I think a lot of the people with more discriminating palates do understand that the ingredients we purchase do not come cheap. And so it's only out of practical economics and not out of a desire to be expensive that we're expensive. Because in Sicily, you wouldn't find that these products are so inaccessible. In Sicily, they're right there at everyone's doorstep.
I mean, and again, in Sicily, they're probably cheaper only because the importation
they're not being air freighted.
Right.
Exactly.
The almonds are everywhere. The pistachios are everywhere. The sheep's milk ricotta is everywhere. And when someone comes into our shop with no matter what the expectations are, the first thing we want them to understand is that our products are comparable to the pastries in Sicily, geographically speaking, and not just that they're to be compared to other bakeries in Chicago that make Italian baked goods, because the comparison is totally different.
Right.
Because not everyone's importing these ingredients, because not everyone is so discriminating in the way that they produce their pastries. We want people to compare us to a Sicilian pastry shop in Sicily.
And there's a lot of places that use powdered mixes to make a custard. We sit there and we stir those eggs for 40 minutes so that they don't burn when you add the milk to them.
I mean, we're separating yolk from white.
Yeah, we're not using like...
Let's talk about... Because I'm curious about the labor that goes into a particular pastry or into a particular cake or something that you guys do. Is there one that, you know, I think I've read that there's something that takes like days or, you know,
I mean,
even the cheese to go into the cannoli every day when we put it in the drainer because it has to strain for 3 days.
The cheese has a moisture content, so the water
so
will...
So every day you have to go down there, dump the extra water, make sure...
It's drying out
to the right consistency, and then that's a three-day process where it needs to be done. Then you need to bring it out here, you need to whip it for a certain amount of time to regain the creaminess, because, I mean, the cheese is... You've lost all its moisture content, but then when you re-whip it, becomes creamy again, just like, how would you describe the process?
It becomes creamy, and then not only that, but then you have the element of the candied citrus peel, and because we candy that, you know, it's a process, it's pretty labor-intensive to candy
peel. This much of citrus peel took us about 12 hours to make.
What is that, like 5 gallons, maybe?
Eight quarts. And that's both orange and lemon. And then when just this much is going to take 12 hours, I mean, that's including...
That's just one ingredient, and it just goes into maybe three items in our whole shop. Mm-hmm. But we'll still take a whole day to make it.
It's because you can't buy candied fruit peel, even if you go to the most expensive...
Distributor,
they cannot produce a product as good as this.
Because the difference between commercial and artisanal, it means that no matter how good quality it is at the commercial level, it's still better at the personal level of one chef working on a house-made product.
How did you guys find these products? Like, how did you identify what you liked or what you needed?
Working in the restaurant business gave us the opportunity to be familiar with some of the companies in the city that import the better quality items. So I think the first thing we did was just sort of went through people that we know, people that we could call. Some reps from these companies helped us out. And there were even a lot of things that, in the end, the company couldn't find for us, but... You know, we gave them a list of products. They found most of them. The things that they couldn't get are the things that we either make or we do without. But when we do without them, we don't substitute with the wrong ingredient.
Who's really good? Like, who's a vendor that has been, you know, people wouldn't know about, but that's amazing? Or, you know.
I think that there are three companies that we can depend on for the out-of-the-way items, which are Isola Imports, European Imports, and Midwest.
And Albert Ooster.
Albert Ooster's
has
very fine products.
Very, like, high-end, like, oh, where's the artichoke? 2 pounds of artichoke we buy, no, pound and three-quarter of artichokes that we buy. They're artichoke hearts. They're imported from Italy that are soaked in extra virgin olive oil instead of the brine that you find here. A pound and three-quarter wholesale for $45.
Yeah, sure. Olive oil alone is expensive.
I mean, that's this much of artichokes for $45 that I'm putting them on my...
On the savory pastries. For example, the artichokes, the other thing that we want people to know about is that the savory pastries really are pastries.
You can tell it's real olive oil. When you put it in the fridge, it solidifies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so one of the things, you know, obviously the proof is in the taste. And, you know, I was in here a couple weeks ago, and everything I had was incredible.
Thank you.
I think the buzz from everybody, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, with so many venues for people talking about food, inevitably there's always people who are like, oh, no, this place sucks, or there's contrarians.
Oh, of course.
But generally speaking, this is like one of the first places I can remember opening where I would say 99% of everything that's said is really good, you know?
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that, I guess, is, you know, reading a little bit about your background, is, you know, I had heard that you had interned or did a little pastry internship, and I think you were in Lebanon, is that right?
Yeah.
Because they have great French pastry culture.
Yeah. And, but I guess my thought would be, to have produced this kind of stuff, like, you'd have to, like, spend 10 years doing this. I wonder how you picked it up so quickly, or...
Well, I didn't pick it up quickly, but when you say that it takes at least 10 years, I would have to say you're absolutely correct. It's only because I've been baking with old ladies, and not necessarily old ladies, but knowledgeable older women. My aunts, my grandmothers, they were bakers, and when I was very young, I was baking with them because our family was... very close.
And this is where you were brought up in Palos Park, is that?
Palos Heights. It's a suburb, but the unique thing about it was that being an Italian family living there, we didn't have a lot of other Italian families, so there wasn't a neighborhood with an Italian deli and an Italian bakery like some of the old Italian neighborhoods had. So instead of being able to go down and pick up the sausages and the focaccias, if you were on Harlem Avenue, you'd have lots of places to go to. But instead of not having those stores, we made them at home because of where we lived, because there wasn't a community supplying the products. So the element of hand making all of my pastries comes from growing up in a family where we did these pastries at holiday time. We did get together and pass on methods of cooking from one family member to the next. And I would have to say even the men in my family were very into it, because my grandfather, for example, made all of the pizza and focaccia doughs that he and my grandmother would make for us. So at least it wasn't one of those, oh, the kitchen is for the women. Like, my husband's in the kitchen with me, and my grandfather was in the kitchen with my grandmother, and my uncle is in the kitchen with my aunt. And when she makes cannoli shells, he sits there with his task, and he rolls out the dough very thin for her. And then she'll cut and shape the cannoli shells, put them on the forms, and fry them. So they put together their own little two-person assembly system. And it was, I think, a very positive influence for me to see people being happy in the kitchen and loving the time that they got to spend. And it wasn't glamorous or exciting. And it wasn't extremely, let's say, exciting to me either, because when I was a kid, I thought it was a little bit boring,
sure.
Except for the times when I got to help, which is when I felt like I learned something. But when I was younger, it was just the way things are, and I thought that everyone's family was like that. And it was when I got older that I realized that not everyone's family does that, and that it was actually very... very precious and rare.
I know. I'm thinking about how I could have grown up in your family. But where did I go wrong? I mean, I love my mom.
Yeah. They were different.
Although I did grow up in a Polish family, and my grandmother used to hand make the pierogies, and like the same thing. Like, we'd roll out the dough. It was like a community affair.
Polish women are baking wizards. They're awesome.
Yes.
They know how to wield a rolling pin.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
In more ways than one.
Yeah. I bet that you can recall, my husband can recall, and I can recall that when we would get hit as kids, it was usually with kitchen instruments like wooden spoons,
yep.
And rolling pins, and you know, sometimes we'd even get a utensil, you know, thrown across the room at us. But that's just because that's what was laying around.
Yeah, my brother and I always joked about my grandmother chasing us around with a wooden spoon, and like, we, you know, at one point we were old enough to get away from her, and it was just like, it became like, I think, can we get her to break out the wooden spoon? Which is horrible, but...
at least you had fun.
Yeah. So is there any particular cookie or something that goes back to, like, when you were 15 and you were doing this? You know, is there a recipe or something that is, like, emblematic of your heritage or what you learned?
Yeah, and I would have to to say more so the home style items than the pastry shop items, because the other thing that's unique about us is that in Sicily, for example, there are certain items that people bake at home, and then there are certain items that they would never make, they would just go to the pastry shop for. But here, because we don't want to exclude either form of baking, we do items that are typically found in the home and items that are typically found in a pastry shop. The cookies, for example, are what most of our customers recognize as things they saw at home, which is what I saw at home. So cassata, for example, is something that a family in Sicily would go to the shop for. They wouldn't typically make it at home. But these lemon cookies and those...
Describe the cassata.
Oh, sure. The cassata is layers of sponge cake that are dampened with a little liqueur. It can be a citrus liqueur, rosewater liqueur, or a fruit liqueur. Ours has a combination. And then the filling inside is pretty generous with the ricotta cream filling, which has bits of chocolate and it has bits of candied citrus. And then it's topped with a lemon glaze, but encased with marzipan. So the marzipan is tinted green, which is that color that tips you off as to what the product is, and it also has some candied fruit.
And that's actually one of the ones that I had when I came here. And I was saying to you on the phone, for me it was sort of a revelation, because I hate marzipan, or what I think of as marzipan, yeah. I think most people do, because it's like this like half-inch thick layer people put on wedding cakes, mm-hmm. and it's like, you know, really
it's
dry and thick.
It's usually
too sweet.
Or too pasty.
And what was interesting about yours was how it was sort of, it was like a very thin layer, it was light, it was well-balanced in terms of the sweetness, mm-hmm. it was, you know, it melted on your tongue, literally.
It's a texture as well.
You didn't have to, like, chew through it, you know?
Yeah.
So, I thought that was kind of...
We're very proud of the marzipan, because we do make it. Mm-hmm. From the first level, every pastry's component is made from scratch. So when you see something that's made up of four different items, you better believe that everyone was made individually first, mm-hmm. and then put together.
Actually, even the syrup, so that would be more than four.
Yeah.
Because we make our own citrus liqueurs, we make our own rosewater liqueurs.
We make a tangerine liqueur.
So you guys do the infusions yourself?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
What do you guys usually use as like a base liqueur for?
You know what? A good quality, smooth vodka is... is what you need. Like, here's vanilla beans soaking in.
Nice.
Yeah, vanilla beans in vodka and tangerine peel or lemon peel in vodka. When you drink something like a limoncello at a restaurant, for example, that's a liqueur that you can make. And it's pretty easy. It's just a matter of waiting for it to
develop.
It
takes about a month and a half to make, just so for the flavor to soak up in vodka. Yeah.
So...
And your family is from Palermo, is that right?
Yeah, right in the heart of the city.
I wondered if Palermo, is the culture, especially around sweets, is it different than anywhere, or is it pretty emblematic of Sicily? Or?
Yes, although I think that you find in Sicily that, just like in other parts of Europe, every town and every place, even if it's a surrounding area or a province, has things that it is particularly proud of, things that are based there, that were created there, and may have traveled to other parts. So, for example, you may find cannoli being made in other regions, but they were born in Sicily. So Sicily is the place where the people would have a notable amount of pride regarding that product. For example, the produce that grows in a particular place is something that the people also cling to as a great source of pride. So if they grow particularly good almonds, or if their sheep make, you know, particularly notable cheeses, you find that the pastries reflect that, because they want so much to have that vehicle for presenting their homegrown products that you can typically find out what it is that people are proud of based on how they use it in their cooking and what comes out and how they present it. Yeah, yeah, you celebrate what's best, and it's best probably because it's right there and it's fresh, and when you get it, it was just made or it was just grown, or you can pick it off your tree and know that it didn't sit on a truck and it didn't have to wait in a warehouse for someone to enjoy it, and that's what makes any local food so great. We're looking into getting organic, locally grown berries, which we started doing a few weeks ago, And the more fruit that we can get now that summer's coming and now that there's so many farmers markets, we want to showcase those fruits. Because while this region doesn't grow exactly the same fruits as the Mediterranean, certain things are you know, we can have in common. Apples, berries. Let's say the berries, the cherries are outstanding here. And so if you look to Michigan and Indiana and Illinois for great produce, you'll be able to find them this summer in our pastries.
Because fresh produce is hard to import.
One of the things I'm interested too in with Sicily is the culinary influences beyond Sicily, beyond Italy. Mm-hmm. I know you guys use rose water, and you know, so I guess that maybe there's some North African. I wonder what other kind of influences there are, and maybe if you know how those came to be, or if
Sure. I mean, in history you'll find Greek, Spanish, North African, Middle Eastern. You know what? You could probably pore for hours over books on war and domination and, the different periods of history concerning art and leadership. And you'll find that when people came through Sicily, they found it a place where good things were already growing, good things were already being eaten. But everyone who came through left their mark in terms of, the things that they loved to eat, they grew there. So the things that they loved to eat, they brought there and they left there. And the people actually adapted to them so that when the people took items that were left by conquerors or visitors, things like honey, pistachios, rose water, even citrus fruits, plums, the things from the Far East, the spices from North Africa. You'll find like coriander and cumin and savory dishes that incorporate sweets and sweet dishes that incorporate, spices. You'll find that in Sicily, the chocolate is most popular when it's dark and bitter. And also, you'll sometimes find that the chocolate has spice in it, which is because when the Spanish brought chocolate from Mexico, had the hot red chili peppers and the cinnamon in it, the Sicilians loved it that way. And so they didn't change it into creamy milk chocolate when the French or when the Swiss began making very rich, creamy chocolates. The Sicilians kept it as a bitter, a dark, an earthy flavor, and they kept the cinnamon and they kept the spice. They did the same thing with jasmine or rose. It's just simple. It's just a water. It's a scented water. There's what else? Like the honey, for example. There are these beautiful bitter honeys. One of the things that I've been really upset I couldn't get, but bitter honey from Sardinia in Sicily is among the most aromatic, complex, rich, earthy honeys you'll find in all the world. Unfortunately, it's one of those things that you can't get because of restrictions on, imported food and homogenization.
You have to make your own.
But there are lemons in Sicily that are so sweet.
Put on the bag.
There's citrus fruit in Sicily that's so sweet and so bright, and lemons that are delicious enough to eat by themselves. Like you could eat Sicilian lemons sweet like they're oranges. They're not so crassly bitter. They're just amazing. The bitter almonds there are the richest, most intense almond flavor you can find. There are some things that actually I wish I could show better, but if you want the real experience, you can come here and get the absolute closest thing to it. And I won't profess to be exactly the same, only because there are certain products I have to say no to because I don't have the right ingredient. But people who travel there, who visited there and eaten there, do come here and are able to find what they've missed other bakeries aren't giving them.
Have you had any native Sicilians come?
Yes.
They've given you good feedback.
Yeah, the feedback with most people is that they'll bite into something we've made, and this look of ecstasy comes across their face, and sometimes their eyes close or their eyelids like will flutter a little bit, and they'll put their head back and say, "Oh my God, it has been years since I had this."
A lot of Europeans also, when they come in, they walk in and the first thing they say, "Oh my God, this is the first pastry shop that actually smells like a pastry shop."
A lot of people come in and say, "Oh, I smell butter."
Yeah.
It's like, of course you do, because we're not using shortening.
And you're baking.
Yeah.
There's no separation between.
And people can see what's going on, and I want them to, because even though it might be a little, might be a little more hectic for us, you know, they get to see our mess sometimes, or they get to see, you know, if something gets forgotten and it burns in the oven, well, then I'm sorry, the shop is going to smell like burned cookies.
But that's the whole experience.
But it's the experience. They get to see that things really are being made here by human beings, not machines, that we're not pulling out buckets of cake mix, that we're actually breaking eggs and making from scratch pastry, and they get to watch it happening.
Yeah, I know. I mean, when I walked in here and then when I left, like, my reaction was, it was like a Fellini fantasy. It was like some kind of like montage from like, you know, 8 and a half or something, where it's like you walk in and there's like, you know, people always throw around food porn, you know, that's like the new thing in the food business. People are like, oh, it's, but it is. I mean, just looking at, you know, like you said, you know, the cassatine and like, you know, I mean, there's just all these many layered things with all these different colors, and it's just amazing.
You should have seen it yesterday. On Saturday and Sunday, when we present most of our pastries, oh, I just want to take a picture of the case and just keep it there, because looks so nice. Different, as you said, we have the chocolate, you have the almonds, you have the tangerine, you have the green marzipan, so all these colors combined together. Because what we're trying to do is not only satisfy the taste, because
it's multi-sensory.
When I worked at Drew, I learned this, like, you got to satisfy all the senses. And then we played Italian music
that is contemporary.
We got this piece from Italy, not the Frank Sinatra. No disrespect to Frank Sinatra or any of the American Italians, but we play really Italian music. And then you come in and the smell is there, and you see it and you taste it. The only one that we're missing is somehow touch.
Mm. Right, because you're not supposed to touch the pastries and squeeze them.
Right.
Yeah, I actually, unfortunately, I had to put a sign, like one of my delicate, so delicate, and people come in here and just start pressing.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but this is craft. This is not
You need demo pastry. You need to like put stuff out that people can.
I didn't put a small sign. I got to the point where I had to put a sign, please do not touch. It's very delicate.
But I understand why people want to pick our things up and hold them. Is because when you see something like this, I think for a lot of people, they feel like they're having the chance to investigate something special that they've never seen before, never been so close to before. And it's a lot like a travel experience, where when you come here, we do want a person to feel like they're stepping into a whole nother zone. It's a small space, but it's a space that I think is filled with a lot of wonderment. Of course, like when people get to watch it being made and then they see it out on the counter, there's a curiosity element that makes you want to pick it up and feel it and know what it's like. Is it soft? Is it crunchy? What's the texture? So I think that the curiosity about texture is what draws a lot of people in to want to investigate what's in front of them.
I like too that it's not a passive experience. Like, I know when I came in here, you were like, well, when are you going to eat these? Because this should be eaten now, and this should be eaten,
oh, yeah.
You know, which is really important,
uh-huh,
because
exactly.
People, you know, there's a guy in Arizona, Chris Bianco, makes pizza, Pizzeria Bianco, and he won't do takeout or delivery
because
it degrades the quality,
right,
of his pizza.
Right.
And you know, maybe whatever, hardcore, but it's you should taste things at their best.
And for example, we tell everybody this cake has buttercream, it needs to be taken out half hour. This cheesecake is best at room temperature because it's not your typical style cream cheesecake. It's actually a ricotta cheesecake.
And
not
the flavor comes
experience.
Out. Yeah, the flavor comes out of great food when it's at room temperature, because when anything's cold, you're not going to get the full experience of the flavors in your mouth, unless it's ice cream,
mm-hmm,
a gelato.
Okay.
But with our pastries, if you let them come to room temperature and you have the willpower and the patience to wait, you'll be able to enjoy them that much more. But as well, like with the texture of the cannoli shells, if the cream sits inside and makes the shell soft, you might as well just not get it and serve your guests something else. And you're right, it's not a passive thing. We're protective about our product. We know what it took to put it out there into the case. And we want people to treat it the right way when they take it, so that for themselves and for the enjoyment of their guests, if they're serving people, we want what has our name on it to come through the way it's supposed to be.
How long did you guys plan this before you opened? Like
a year.
A year.
A year.
I don't know. Because it was location that was very important for us. And then we were looking around. But we were planning, like thinking about it. But then when it happened, because we found this location like out of the blue, and it was like, had to be like, okay, we have to sign a lease now.
Yeah.
Now it's getting down to business.
We felt that we had a lot of time until we signed the lease, which is when you discover you have to do it as quickly as humanly possible.
You gotta pay the rent.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're a poli sci major from UIC, right?
I went to UIC first. I had transferred to DePaul a few years ago, and I was there ever since.
And you're an engineering guy. Why those disciplines, you know? I mean, obviously, you probably didn't envision you were going to be doing this 5 years out. But I'm curious why you guys made those choices or what you were thinking at that point.
Excuse me. I'm Lebanese, and in Lebanon, they push you, especially if you're smart in math. That's the direction they send you, engineering. If it was, like, if I had the chance to go back and think about it, I won't do it.
Yeah. That's not Lebanese, that's American too. My parents, same thing.
Oh, really?
You know, it's like science and math.
Yeah.
You know,
your parents want you to do something that you'll get a great paycheck doing. And even if it's not what you want to do, there's a certain element where you might want to please your parents and make them feel very proud of you. And so when my husband did engineering and he realized that it's not something he actually wanted to do for the rest of his life, it was like, well, already almost got this degree, might as well finish it.
Yeah, I mean, literally last year in my engineering school, I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to do it just to finish it. I did graduate with honors. I don't know how, but...
But actually, it's surprising because we didn't think that doing something like this would make our parents very proud. We thought that they would consider it foolish or frivolous or just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But when they had those initial reactions of it being foolish and whatnot, it actually changed very quickly.
Very quickly.
Very quickly. And it became something that they had criticized us for the weeks and weeks of build-out when this place was under construction. And they were worried every day and calling us to find out, well, what's going wrong today? And we told you so, this is too hard for you to do. And then the place was up and running, and people were coming in, and the exposure that the media gave us exploded us right out there into the big picture, and all of a sudden our parents got it, and they became very supportive, and they began to see that this was something that was really special, and that it wasn't just
her
luck.
Dad started coming here every day to help out.
Yeah, and I thought previously
but when
that
we first opened, her mom was here every day too. Like, literally, they were here every
day. My mom
day.
Was scrubbing the tiles in this place, and my dad was in his old age doing things that I don't even know where he found the energy to do them.
Or ever done before.
I've never
seen her dad in an apron.
that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's a definition of success.
Yeah.
And so as long as you're successful, it doesn't matter how it comes or where it comes. I mean, obviously, if it's illegal, maybe not.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Like, I'm the best exotic dancer on all the strip or something like that.
But, you know, that's the thing is, like, you can be that. And, you know, it's like, it's amazing the things that you can do. You know, there's somebody who's the best garbage person that's ever been, and they made a business out of it and became a millionaire or whatever it is. You know, and I think that's a lesson, you know. It's like, you just have to devote to whatever you do, and, you know.
They're only sorry that they don't get to see us very much anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The money for this business, part of it came also from family, didn't? Wasn't it like inheritance or something like that?
Part of it.
Yeah, it was, part of the reason we were able to do this financially was because my grandparents set aside money for each one of us. And technically, we weren't supposed to have it until I was of a certain age. But it became available, and it seemed like the right thing to do. And it was a huge risk because it was something that I knew would always be there to help me pay student loans or to help me with a down payment on a condo. And there are probably a lot more practical things I could have done with it. And even if my grandfather was alive, he would have told me there were more practical things that I could have done with it. He probably would have been quite angry with what I was doing with it. But I knew that if I could keep him quiet, which he is, because he's passed away, then he would, I think he would support it very much in the same way that my parents were first critical and now supportive. And I only wish that they were around, because if they were able to see what I did to bring a part of their homeland down onto the 5400 block of Clark Street, would have been very, very sort of out of this world experience for them. Because I know that there were lots of things that they missed about home that they couldn't get. Like I said, they had to make it themselves. But I think that just having that feeling of walking into a place and it feeling like back home would have been very emotional for them. It's emotional for me.
Yeah. What has surprised you guys most about this business, or not this business in particular, but opening your own business that you didn't think of, or, you know, either whether it's a delightful surprise or it's a scary surprise?
For me, go ahead.
I think that training people.
Exactly.
And having employees that don't have the same sense of pride and don't have the same sense of heritage or connection with the pastries. It's like you don't just teach them these are the ingredients and this is how you put it together. You're also teaching people why it's this way and how to appreciate it in the form that it's in, and why it's so important not to change it or not to misinterpret it. And it's no criticism against the fact that these are other human beings who just simply didn't grow up the same way.
Right.
But to teach someone in a few weeks how to treat food that you've been touching your whole life is extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm. So you guys are stranded on an island, Sicily maybe, but in a remote part and you can't get anywhere else. What's the one pastry you guys take with you?
The chocolate cake.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's dark, bittersweet chocolate, and it's very tender cake. And the Italian buttercream is so light. It's a meringue based buttercream, and it's so rich and it's so satisfying that I'm almost positive that I could live on it. Yeah, but if I had to choose one of the older, more traditional, Sicilian pastries from hundreds and thousands of years. The ones that have been, you know, that they've been making for as long as anyone could remember. Probably the cannoli. They're the most blissful and perfect and satisfying things I've ever had in my life. And I actually remember the first time I really had cannoli, because having them here meant that my aunt couldn't get the sheep's milk ricotta that we can get as a pastry shop, because personal individuals don't have access to these items, right?
Sure.
When we first went to Palermo, and I'd been eating my aunt's cannolis, she lives here, I remember the room I was in, I remember that I was facing the sea, I remember what was going on the television, and I remember that my aunt was sitting in the room with me. She brought them from the local pastry shop, and they were eye-opening. They were completely life-changing.
How old were you?
I was 15. And you can have Italian food here as much as you want, but nothing will prepare you for eating in Italy right off the table of everyday Italian people.
What? So maybe it's the homes. I was going to say, is there a shop or is there a place in Sicily that you remember that's kind of emblematic, that if somebody was going to go, they should go there?
Oh, yeah. There was this incredibly beautiful, elegant, upscale seafood restaurant. And, of course, we were taken there because my family would normally eat at home. They would normally not spend a terrific amount of money on going out to eat. But we were guests, and when Italians show their guests around, they show them by emptying their wallets completely. Mm-hmm. And you know how it is. You know that they don't have money to pay for where they're taking you, but they refuse to let you pay, and they refuse to let you argue. And you know that they don't have it.
Just like us, just like Lebanese people.
My husband's father would spend money that we know he doesn't have.
Like, he'll fight with me. I'm on vacation. I brought the money. I can spend it. Yeah. You are living here day to day, not knowing if you're going to have money for
it's
the next
It's
an
incredible amount of hospitality.
Just let me take care of it. And if you do, he will be set for hours.
But when they take you out to eat at the best places, and the seafood, for example, is what I remember, I can't enjoy seafood here in the Midwest after having tasted fresh seafood right out of the Mediterranean
Sea. Not too much mercury in the Mediterranean Sea.
It's like eating a whole nother food.
Different kind of fish too, also.
And it's all within 24 hours.
Yeah, it's like the freshest it can get.
Well, but it's also the way that the people handle it. I think the reason that Midwesterners don't treat fish very well is because they don't live with fish. They don't live on the shore of the ocean, and they don't live in communities that that derive their entire economic standing on the seafood. And so there's a different respect towards ocean life because that's how the people, you know, make money. That's how they pay their bills. And when a community depends on the fishing, I just think that the people respect and understand the seafood better because they live right there. They know how to treat it.
You mentioned the Harlem area, the northwest side of Chicago, which is kind of a big Italian food enclave anyways. I wondered, are there places, you know, savory-wise, things that you think about locally that, I don't know if it's the same kind of craft, but that are emblematic for you? You know, either good, like, cured meats or things that that you think about or that you love in Chicago?
Well, yes, but I will say that I don't eat prepared Italian meals in restaurants. I'll go down to Harlem to shop at the delis to be able to get bresaola, prosciutto.
I just had a good homemade hot soppressata from Riviera.
Amazing cured meats and the bottled imported items, you know, to be able to get marinated Mediterranean tuna in, you know, packed in olive oil, or to be able to get great big delicious caper berries or roasted peppers or whatever have you. We go pick those things up and we prepare them at home. But I think that for us, it's much more gratifying not to attempt to enjoy Italian food in restaurants because we don't even go anymore.
Yeah.
We'd rather go and have a meal at a restaurant that we don't know how to prepare ourselves.
Is there a good place for Lebanese that reminds you of home at all? Or?
Yeah, Mazza, I would say, right?
Mazza, yeah.
Yeah.
It's right on Lincoln. Just south of Diversey on Lincoln Avenue.
Yeah.
What's special about it is that it's not a fast food falafel stand.
Yeah.
It's actually a sit-down.
It's sit-down, and it's fine dining, but even more than that, it's just, it's regional.
Oh, it's white tablecloth. I wouldn't consider it fine dining.
Maybe not fine dining.
Just got white tablecloth, and the guy owns the place.
He does everything.
He serves, he cooks, he pours the drinks.
He shops for the produce.
Yeah, he does it all.
It's more like eating at the home of a Lebanese family than at a restaurant, which is what's nice about it.
Yeah, he does a lot of, I mean, besides, kebabs are very, like, if you go order kebabs, that's very everywhere. But if you want something that's really, like, for me, if I go there, I either order the stuffed cabbages in the tomato sauce or the stuffed zucchini in the tomato sauce, like a nice lamb.
Or the raw lamb.
Or
the,
he has a raw lamb tartare that you can't find anywhere else in the city. I mean, that's, don't remind me.
Yeah.
I'm hungry now.
Now you know where you're going for lunch. What?
They open dinner.
Dinner. There you go. You know, one of the things you were talking about was this idea of getting some local ingredients like berries and things like that. Obviously, you can still hew to the Sicilian traditions with whatever berries you get here. I wondered if, you're a product of Sicilian heritage, Lebanese heritage, as well as American heritage.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder about, like, that merging in what you guys do. Have you guys thought about that? Thought about, you know, is there a pastry or is there something either you do or you want to do that, you know, merges those things and it's a better product as a result? Or is it more still about just hewing to the classics all the time, or I don't know?
We haven't done that yet because we're so new. We've been building our repertoire of very traditional expected pastries. But the really cool thing about Italians is that they're always reinventing. The people themselves are extremely creative and resourceful. And, you know, we have imported fruits in Italy just like we have them here. So, sure, you won't find guava or pineapple or, you know, certain tropical fruits growing in Italy, or especially Sicily because it's a desert landscape. But aside from what already grows there, I mean, they import pineapples just like we do, and they import bananas just like we do, and they import kiwis just like we do. So it is actually easier than you think, because in Italy right now, people are being inventive. They are expanding on what's already there.
Oh, that's why we're trying to go in September.
We're actually going to Sicily in September, and I want to be doing a lot of research. Now that the business has been running for these last few months, I know better what it is that I want to specifically find out. And the more information we have, the better we'll be able to do, and then the more questions that we'll have to go back with and further gain this knowledge, because things are changing there every day just as well.
I always ask this sort of in a different form or another, but this idea of, you know, when you eat, and as you guys have pointed out repeatedly, it's about the food, but it's also about, you know, the gathering of your friends and your family, the generosity and the spirit in your surroundings. I think of the idea of food and, like, the central idea of, like, a dinner party. And, like, you say, you know, you were going to have, like, a pastry gathering, and you could invite anybody you wanted to invite, you know, living, dead. Who would you guys want there?
Yeah.
You want me there?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like my husband to be there. I would love for my parents and my grandparents to be there. I think Anthony Bourdain should join us.
I think Mario Batali.
I think Mario Batali should join us. But I also think that I'd love to have people, like, just that we know in our everyday lives, that we know don't often enough get to slow down and stop what they're doing and sit down and enjoy a night of just socializing and just being together. So, like, old friends that we haven't seen in a very long time. We don't see our friends. Like, I miss my regular old friends. Sophia Loren would be there for sure, because she's my idol. And if I could just be half the woman that Sophia is, I think I could die very happy.
What would you talk to her about?
Oh, God. I think, first of all, for example, she's the epitome of what a woman who walks into the room and stops everyone from what they're doing, you know. I think that I want to ask her what it is that she finds in herself to be as old as she is, and to still be able to stop traffic when she walks across the street. It has to be in the personality. It has to be coming out of the person. You can't put that much makeup and jewels on an old woman and have her come out the way Sophia does. She just radiates youthful beauty.
It's confidence.
And I'm sure that it's money as well, but it's got to be some sort of secret joy, just, you know, that joy of just really being alive, you know. I think I'd want to ask her what she could tell me.
She's Sophia Loren.
You know. Well, thanks for doing this, guys.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Thanks for listening to Chefs on the Grill. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and as always, drop us a line at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. See you next month, and in the meantime, stay hungry.
One more time.